we may begin. The last couple of weeks, we've spoken broadly about a number of issues in terms of the Book of Midbar, both in terms of the approaches taken to it by a number of the classical commentators, and a survey that we did last week, focusing particularly on the relationship of the halachot, of the legal material in the Sefer, to the narrative, with a particular focus on the relationship of the Sefer to the land of Israel, to Eretz Yisrael. What we'll do this evening is we will take a single segment of the Sefer, the segment dealing with the adventures of Bnei Yisrael at the place which will later be named Kivrot HaTa'ava in Perek Yud Aleph, in chapter 11. And we will study this text with two goals in mind, or perhaps looking at two aspects of the text, about which I'll say something in a moment. First of all, this particular narrative, the story about the murmuring at Kivrot HaTa'ava, belongs to a group of stories in the Torah which are found both in Sefer Shemot, particularly in Parshat B'Shalach, and in Sefer B'Midbar, particularly beginning in Parshat B'Halotcha, then in Shlach, Korach, and Chukat. And these are the stories about the complaints, or the murmuring, or the rebellions, depending on how we're going to characterize them, of Bnei Yisrael as they travel through the desert. And it's quite clear, even upon a cursory glance, that the way in which Bnei Yisrael are treated, the way the Torah describes their behavior in Sefer Shemot, and the way in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats them, is somewhat different from the way that the Torah describes them and they are treated in the book of Bimidbar. The actions are the same. In fact, the storylines are very, very similar. And nevertheless, the results are different. And it is, I think, quite reasonable to ask ourselves why this difference in the way the Israelites are treated in the desert, seemingly for the same thing that they did in Parshat B'Shalach, they are punished much more stringently in Parshat B'Halotcha or later on. Indeed, there is a particular group of stories, sort of a subset of the larger set, which deals with demands for food or for water. That is to say, if we go through the whole list of things that take place. So we have the story of right after Yitziat Mitzrayim, Kriyat Yamsuf, we have them coming to Marah, and then we have them a little bit later in Midbar Sin, complaining for lack of food and getting the man in return. A moment after that, they go to Rephidim, and they have no water. The only other major rebellion in Shemot, of course, and one of the rebellion par excellence, of course, is the Maaseh HaEgel, the Egel HaZahav. And then we come to Bamidbar, and we have a whole list of things like this. We have the Metonanim, which we'll see just briefly in a moment. We have the story of the complaining, asking for flesh at Kivrot HaTa'ava. Then, of course, the Meraglim and Korach, which are not food complaints. We then have Meimariva, which is a complaint for water. We have the story of the Nechashim Hasrafim, the attack by the fiery serpents, which also is generated by a complaint about the man. Then you have Bnei Gad, Bnei Ruvain, which is not a story about food. So if we look at the stories as a group, and particularly at the stories about food, there is really a strong line of similarity, and at the same time a line of dissimilarity with the material in Shemot. Because if you look at it, the pattern in Shemot is that Bnei Yisrael get someplace or other, they don't have, let's say in one case they don't have water, they complain, Moshe turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Vayitzak, he cries out, he prays, and they receive water. Shortly thereafter, they get to Midbar Sin, they complain, And again, listen to the language of the complaint. Halavai, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, b'shivtenu al sir habasar, while we sat by the flesh pots, b'ochleinu lechem lasova, when we ate bread or food to our heart's content. You've taken us out into this desert to kill us all with hunger. And the response, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe, is you're going to get food from heaven. This is going to be a test for you. Are you going to be able to put up with my Torah? Moshe tells the people about this, and the man follows with the subsequent commandment about Shabbat, and so on. They go to Rephidim. Again, there's no water. Quite legitimately, the people complain about it. Moshe says, what are you arguing with me? And he calls out to Hashem, people are about to stone me, and you have the test at Chorev, and Moshe strikes the rock and water comes out. B'nai Yisrael are not punished. There is no sense that God is dissatisfied with the behavior of the people in asking. They may ask a little bit harshly, but their actions are not perceived on the whole as a lack of faith. With the possible exception of the people who go out to look for the man on Shabbat after having been told not to, their actions are not looked upon as a sign of an abandonment of trust or of faith in God. And the suggestion has been made before, and I think it's quite plausible that B'nai Yisrael are given a certain leeway by God as they come out of Egypt. They don't yet have full faith in Him. They don't have sufficient reason to have full faith in Him. There is something that's still holding them back. They still are unsure of making their way through the desert. God cuts them a little slack. He gives them a little bit of room to complain, to ask, and so on. It's not a question of, first of all, in the experience in the desert, if you remember the characterization that we heard in the name of Nitziv a couple of weeks ago, Nitziv speaks about their whole existence in the desert, the whole process as being what we would call Lamala Miderech HaTeva. They are living in a supernatural world. A world where your next meal, you're not carrying it along with you, but it comes down from heaven every day, is a world where at least as far as in the sort of the standard way that we use the term of Ein Som Chin Al Hanes, that idiom is really completely out of place, because obviously they are living a life which does involve a reliance on God to that degree. And in fact, that's why God may call it a test back there in the beginning, where he says they're going to go out every day to take the man, lema'an anasenu hayelech betogatiyim lo, in order that I might test him. Now, what's the test? One of the tests, as many commentators have pointed out, is not having your next day's food in front of you, having to rely on God to supply you day in, day out with your food is something which is a test of one's faith. So in the course of traveling in the desert and being supported by God in these miraculous ways, B'nai Yisrael get to show their faith. In fact, what we'll talk about as we go along here, one of the issues which I think is very important in the story at Kibrot HaTa'ava is, and the reason I called the talk A Crisis of Faith and Leadership, is this very issue of B'nai Yisrael and the way in which they now seem to be relating to God after having seen a year's worth of God's activities in the desert. When we look at Moshe's behavior back in Parshat B'Shalach, he prays to God whenever he's called upon. He doesn't shirk his responsibility. He doesn't complain about having to lead the people. He does that once back in Parshat Shmot, in a passage that we will look at a little bit later. When needed, he steps into the breach, whether it is at the time of the Egel or at the time of any of the shortages of food. So Moshe is a leader who is ready to put himself forward on behalf of his people whenever they need. What we will consider, again, anticipating, in the course of looking at the section of Halotcha that we will look at this evening is the question whether there is something happening in the character of Moshe or in the nature of the leadership of Moshe which makes it appear different from that which we saw back in Sefer Shemot. In fact, if you take the most outstanding example of Moshe's behavior along these lines is, of course, his behavior at the time of the Egel, where God is ready to start Am Yisrael over with him, and Moshe says, showing a chutzpah, which is unbelievable, and says, you know, if this is what you're going to do, forget about it, take me out also. Mecheni nami sifrecha shir katavta, I don't want any part of this, if you are not going to give the people. And, of course, God, in response, as it were, kaviyachol to Moshe's behavior, does forgive the people. So Moshe is, you know, the leader that you want to have in front of you at that time. When we look at the subsequent stories, what's very interesting is in the story as told in Bishalach, we are told about Man. There is one verse in Bishalach, Perek Tet Zayin Pasuk Chet, where after having talked about God has told him what is going to happen, Moshe says, "Vayomer Moshe, b'teit Adonai lachem ba'erev basar le'echol v'lechem ba'boker l'sbo'a b'shmo Adonai tlunoteichem asher atem alinim alav v'nachnu malo olenu tlunoteichem ki al Adonai." When God gives you in the evening flesh to eat and bread or some other kind of food in the morning, and so on and so forth, and then you have, in addition to that, you have a half a pasuk, Yud Gimel, the same perek, Vahi Va'erev, it was in the evening, Vatal Haslav, the quail or whatever they are, went up, Vatchas Tamachanan, and covered the camp. There's not a word in Bishalach other than those two comments, Basar Ba'erev and Vatal Haslav. That's all we're told about the meat. The focus in Bishalach is completely on man, on the daily bread which is supplied to Bnei Yisrael. And the question has been raised, and again I will anticipate, if the slav is happening ever since Bishalach, what are they asking for here in Balotcha? And I think that the simplest answer may very well be that the Torah's mention there of slav either is meant to be a one-time occurrence, or it's meant to be really an anticipation of what we are going to see here in Bahalotcha. It's not meant to be part of the your presumption about the everyday narrative. I mean, this plays to the point that I had mentioned, again, parenthetically, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, later last week or 2 weeks ago, where I referred to the view of Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, who believes that the stories that look like they happened twice really only happened once, and that the Torah chooses to tell them twice for a variety of literary and theological reasons. That would solve the problem very, very easily, but his view is particularly a minority view. He's not the only one who holds it, but it's a very minority view, and it's a view which was attacked by commentators. Ibn Ezra attacks it when somebody else says it, and he's attacked by some of the other Baalei HaTosafot as well. Let's turn to our parsha, to Parshat Balotcha. And where are we here? Where are we in the story, so we can sort of focus ourselves? Bnei Yisrael are now about to travel to Eretz Yisrael. They're on their way, right? We've just had the scene with Yitro, where Moshe invites him to come to the land. We've just seen the first set of traveling, putting together the camps, aiming to go to Eretz Yisrael. The Aron is going ahead of them. We have the short parasha of Ahi ben Soah Aron, and they are now on their way. And all of a sudden, the first thing we get is a pair of misbehaviors, a pair of murmurings or rebellions by Bnei Yisrael. And this is the pattern of behavior which is about to develop in Prakim Yud Aleph through Yud Zayin here in Bamidbar and in Perakaf as well. And it's a pattern which is worth following, and we are going to focus in, as I said, we're going to learn one segment closely inside, but it pays to look at this further as you go through these stories here in Bamidbar, and to look at the characteristics and the qualities of the people and how they do or don't look forward, look ahead, and to look at the characteristics and qualities of Moshe Rabbeinu and the way in which he does guide the people, how is he able to guide the people. And this parsha that we're looking at today really serves, I think, as a very, very important dividing point. And then, of course, we have to think about the dual effect of these parallel sets of observations. On the one hand, we watch the leader. On the other hand, we watch his flock, and we watch as each of them seem to develop in different ways, psychologically perhaps, although I hesitate to use that term, and perhaps from looking at the two together, we will understand something about how Bnei Yisrael are going to behave in the future as we watch them behaving in Parshat Bahalotcha. It's not really a question of the number of rebellions, but perhaps the nature, and maybe rebellion is too strong a term. Sometimes murmuring might be a better one. I mention in passing, but I will come back to it, and I think this is actually very, very important, especially for those of you who have Tanakhs rather than Chumashim, it will be of value. The story that we're going to look at today is retold in Tehillim, at a little bit of length. And it's very important, I think, because Sefer Tehillim, in those chapters where the Meshorerim repeat the history of Bnei Yisrael in the desert, and by that I refer to Ayin Chet, Kuf Hei, and Kuf Vav, not to mention, you know, Kuf Lamed Hei and so on, but the ones where you actually get some narrative, we have, in effect, one of the earliest commentaries on the wilderness wanderings, or on the narratives of the wanderings, because already within Tanakh I see how the Meshorer has chosen to retell the story, and that retelling may enlighten our reading a little bit later on if we have a chance. I think it will be of some value because there are certain things which are ambiguous in the parasha. There are certain aspects of the story where actually, there are disputes not just among Rishonim, but even already in the time of Chazal, they had difficulties understanding certain parts of the text. And I think looking at the material in Tehillim may give us some valuable insights. There are two stories here. The first one, and we will deal with it fairly quickly, is the story of the Mit'oninim. And what makes us deal with the story very, very quickly is that the Torah doesn't tell us very, very much. It's ambiguous. Vayhi am ki mit'onanim, and we usually will translate the word mit'onanim to mean to complain, but the word l'hit'onen occurs only twice in Tanakh. It occurs here, and it occurs in Eicha, ma'yit'onen adam chai gever al chata'av, which is the only other place that it occurs, and you guess on the basis of each place what it means in the other. It's not clear what the etymology of the word is. There is a good deal of dispute among the classical commentators, you know, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, and so on, nobody is really certain what the word means, but it clearly means that they're kvetching or they're aggravated, something like that. And God becomes angry. We don't know why they're doing it. We don't know why God becomes angry. We do see that they are punished by fire, it would appear. The simple sense might even be that the fire burned around the edges of the camp, although clearly in Chazal it either means it burned the leaders of the people or the lowest class of the people. One could read the words Vatochal Bikzei HaMachaneh to mean that a divine fire encircled the camp and the people immediately panicked. They saw this as a sign of divine anger, even without any individuals dying or being injured in any fashion, because the Torah doesn't say that this happens. Later on, when people die in Kivrot HaTa'ava, we are told that people are dying. Here we aren't told. One would argue, Al Pi Pshat read, that Vatocha B'Kzei HaMachaneh means there is a sign from God that the people's behavior is unacceptable before him. They cry out to Moshe. Moshe does exactly what he is trained to do. He turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and prays, Vatishka HaEsh, and the fire sinks down. The place is called Tav'era, so we have some kind of ideological story here. The place is named for the event which took place, Ki Va'aravam Esh Hashem. It's the whole story. We can't be certain what's happening here. Therefore, it creates a certain sense when we read it that the people aren't being quite right, but we don't know how. That the people are somehow showing a deficiency, some kind of character flaw, but we can't really tell what it is that they're what they're doing wrong. By the way, as you know, that Chazal talk about the position of the little parasha of Vayhi ben Soa, and the location of this. Why is this placed where it is? And the answer which is given in Chazal is, we are told this is not the place where it really belongs. It's moved and put here away from where it really belongs. Lahafsik bein pur anut lufur anut, to separate between two punishments which are to be undergone by Bnei Yisrael. And it's very hard when you read the story, you don't see it separating particularly between two acts of divine punishment. You do find the idea in Chazal that one of the acts of misbehavior is the idea ketino kaboreach mi beit hasefer. They can't wait to get away from Har Sinai, the place where all of these restrictions and mitzvot and injunctions were placed upon them, and they run away from Har Sinai ketino kaboreach mi beit hasefer. The image of the tinok, and I don't know whether Chazal have this in mind or not, is going to be a very interesting one for us as we come to read the following section. So it's interesting that Chazal choose to characterize Bnei Yisrael at this moment as being somewhat impetuous, somewhat childish, you know, running away. You know, it's the end of school now, the last bell rings, and you're gone for the summer. This is Bnei Yisrael leaving Har Sinai. They don't, without a glance back at it, without a sense of reverence for the awe of the place where they received the Torah, they're on their way. You know, if that's the case, then again, this is also part of the, at least midrashically, of the decline of the people who received the Torah at Sinai and somehow have not been able to remain on that spiritual level, and even for that 1 year that they're there. The major story, of course, and the one which we're focusing on, is the story at Kivrot HaTa'ava. Of course, it isn't called Kivrot HaTa'ava till the end of the story, but we'll just call it that because I don't know what else to call it. It's a blank space in the desert which is waiting for its name. And let's, as we read, I want to pay close attention to the literary structure of the section to see how sensitivity to the literary structure may tell us something about the meaning of the text. Notice, first of all, that despite what we might have expected, and I know it's very hard to say what we might have expected, there is no Masoretic break. There's no parasha ptucha or parasha stuma. There is no section marking after pasuk gimel. You might have expected that the two stories should be separated from one another by the mark in the Torah, the blank space which separates between two segments. And there isn't one, which makes you think of them more together. In other words, it's a story which has two parts to it, even though one part is completely almost mysterious. Nevertheless, it's Taveira is followed immediately by Kivrot HaTa'ava without so much as a breath taken in between. So even the way that it's written sort of formally may force us to combine the two. There are a number of things which I think one could suggest about which you can't prove anything. I think you may be right that this indicates that they go right into the next complaint without a moment's reflection, without having taken anything. And I don't think your comment is drash necessarily. I think that this may be a sense for the reading of the text as well. It's only that we can't be sure of it. It's not general. It's mysterious, right? What else might lead us to connect back is the word vayashuvu. Vayashuvu vayivku. Vayashuvu means they're doing something again. And it's possible that the use of vayashuvu vayivku is also meant to attach this to the incident which preceded, that this is yet another example of the people's complaining. We can't be certain, but it's certainly it is certainly a possibility. Rashi attacks Vayashuvu in a different way. He says first Vasafsuf, Vayashuvu means, and then Bnei Israel followed them. I'm not so sure that needs to be has to be accepted as the simple sense of the text, but I certainly would again consider this as a possible link to the previous section of the story. It doesn't. It says Ha'am the first time, and even though Rashi says Ein Ha'am Ela Rishaim, that's a very convenient comment. I mean, obviously the Am is the Am, and Rashi wants to emphasize that it's the Rishaim of the people, and therefore he uses that terminology. But except for it says Ha'am, not the Erev Rav the first time. I mean, I'm just saying this. I can't read Asafsuf over the Am in the text. It's not, it doesn't say Erev Rav, it says Asafsuf. Now, we instinctively have this presumption, which is not accidental and maybe based on the form of the words. Notice Asafsuf is a three-letter root with the last two letters repeated. Erev Rav is a three-letter root followed by the last two letters, even though it's not written as one word, it's written as two words. We got Erev Rav, Allah. Here, Asafsuf and Erev Rav, certainly you're tempted to read them as being one and the same. What's particularly interesting, and here I don't know the whole answer, but as an observation, I believe it's some import. Notice the presence of the root Aleph Samach Pei, which I alluded to two times ago, actually. So notice how it plays through both Perek Yud Aleph and Perek Yud Beit. As we go through it, we're going to see that it's there, and it will continue into the Miriam story as well. And when you see this, you can see that the Torah is using literary building blocks to hold something together. The first function of, obviously the first function is for the word to have meaning in its context, but the first literary function is to integrate, to pull together a story in such a way that you don't miss the pointers. We'll see in our story that the word ruach occurs similarly, although not quite as frequently, don't get quite as heavy a dose of it, but these are words which are significant, the Leitwörter or the key words in the story, the way the Torah tells it. In Dvarim Tet Kafbeit, v'taveirav masav v'taveirav masav v'kibrot ha'tavah maksifim heitem et Hashem. In the middle of Moshe's retelling of the story of the Egel, he throws that one-liner out at them. And to be very honest, I mean, I wondered what I was going to be able to say about that pasuk, because that's the only other reference later in Torah to it. Moshe does not go into a whole retelling of Kivrot Tava or Taveira. It's interesting, he splits Taveira and Kivrot Tava by Masa, which we usually take to mean by Krashem HaMakom Masa Umriva back in Perek Yud Zayin of Shmot in the story about the water. So certainly it looks as if Moshe puts those three place names together as if they have something in common. But it doesn't, since Taveira we have no story, since Masa we know is the story about water, all it is, these are three more places where Bnei Yisrael angered God in addition to the story of the Egel, which is what is going on when Moshe is actually telling the story. But beyond that, you don't have any reference, and it doesn't shed light because that reference itself is so terse and so enigmatic. Now, Hitavu Tava. Tava is a very strong word. It may be an intrinsically negative word. In other words, you have lotit aveh as a commandment. Tava may be a word they lusted a lust, they desired a strong desiring. It's picked up when the story is told in Tehillim again, the word is used there. If it's not intrinsically negative, certainly from the way the story is told, it takes on a negative cast. One of the themes that plays through all of the complaints, virtually, from the time they leave Egypt onward, and it's very, very striking, is this constant looking back to Egypt. I mentioned it briefly earlier. Here it pays to pay some more attention to it. You know, Hamibli ein kvarim b'mitzrayim lekachtanu lamut b'midbar. Mazot asita lanu lo tziyanu b'mitzrayim. Right? We could have died in Egypt just as well as here. Why do we have to die here? That's already at Yamsuf. Later on, when they run out of water, halavai, we should have died at the hand of God in the land of Egypt when we had all of that good meat. You took us out to kill us with hunger. In Rephidim, why did you take us out to kill us off with thirst? Right? So always, why did you take us out of Egypt? Why did you take us out of Egypt? Now, certainly in those initial stages, if we look at the Shemot type of the narrative, they're still in the desert. They haven't gotten used to living in the desert under supernatural protection. They run out of water. You understand why they complain. And there's a very natural complaint. In Egypt, at least we had water. Right? In Egypt, at least we had food. You go back and you look, they're not asking for basar explicitly. They don't say we remember the good old days in Egypt, but they do say, you know, we remember what it was like when we were in Egypt when we had food. So the what I'll call the remembrance of Egypt theme is one that occurs in all of the passages in Shemot, and it will run through all of the passages of the rebellions here in Bamidbar as well. Here, Pasuk Hey, later on, one more time, then in the story of the Meraglim, Lumatnu Be'eretz Mitzrayim, Halavai, we should have died in Egypt, Halo Tov Lanu Shuv Mitzrayim, it's better for us to go back to Egypt, Nitna Rosh V'Nashuva Mitzrayim, let's appoint a leader and go back to Egypt. Then, in the story of Korach, you took us out of a land, Zavat Chalav Udvash, as was pointed out correctly, not only didn't you bring us to a land of Chalav Udvash, you took us out of a land of Chalav Udvash, you're going to kill us all here in the desert. The same thing is true by Mei Merivah, the same thing is true with the Nechashim Hasrafim. Why did you take us out of Egypt to die in the desert? It's a single theme that links all of the murmurings, all of the rebellions. But the nature of the complaint here is different from the nature of the complaint back in Bishalach. What they're complaining, they complain as follows. First they say, Mi achilenu basar. We want meat. Who is going to feed us meat? And that who, okay? By now they should know who, right? They know the answer to me. If they're going to get meat now, they know where it's going to come from, right? They have seen God's hand at work in all of these stories until now. What do you mean, mi achilenu basar? This is a statement of a certain lack. Here you clearly see the lack of faith or the lack of trust on the part of the people. And on top of it, they make this complaint. Zacharnu et hadagash enochal b'mitzrayim chinam. We remember the fish that we used to eat in Egypt, right, for free. And all these good vegetables that we had. And now our appetites are dry. All we have is this man. They complain about the quality of the food, namely how good it was. Notice they don't even mention that they had meat in Egypt. Fish they had, they don't even mention meat. Is this all an excuse? And the other thing is, it was chinam. Now, Chazal make the very perceptive comment, it's chinam min ha-mitzvot. You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us food, but it comes at a price. We pay for it with all this list of mitzvot that we have to keep, that we have to observe. Right. Of course. But it's more than that, because Egypt becomes a positive symbol. You know, we asherot, God characterizes Egypt for Am Yisrael as Beit Avadim, the place where they were enslaved. Bnei Yisrael look at Egypt as the place where we had it good. The place where we had satiety. It's a symbol of satiety, of plenty, not of slavery. They somehow or other, and this is true of the people through the desert, and very clear in this parasha, the people simply don't have any long-term memory, right? They don't remember what Egypt really was. All they can remember is this one way in which Egypt seems in their memory to be a better place to be than where they are now. Oh yeah, this is very first generation. The ones who haven't had Egypt taken out of them. What's really... Excuse me. What didn't he keep? Wait. To do that in Korach, I understand. To do that by the time the story reaches the place of Korach, I hear it. Here, they're on their way traveling. Right? They've traveled for 3 days from Har Sinai. So to give them the benefit of the doubt of such a strong argument, I think is really pushing it a little bit. They don't say anything about where they are. They seem to be complaining about the food. Now, I want to know what's really bothering them. This is true. The people rely on Moshe. It's clearly true. Until now, and it runs through Chumash, the people don't act on their own. They do expect Moshe to be the intercessor. Even in Bamidbar Kaf, where the people come to Moshe, Vayavo Moshe Vayamru Chatanu Ki Dibarnu B'Hashem Vavach Hitalel El Hashem V'Yaser Me'Aleinu Atanachash. You please pray to Hashem and let the snakes be taken away from us. And that's an interesting point, that through Torah it would appear that the people have not learned how to deal with God directly. This is part, I think, of the development of the heightening of the sensitivity of the people to what we would call a more personal relationship with God. But you're certainly correct that if you go through the Torah, the people do not get. I can't think of any place where the people, as a group, direct words to Hashem. Now, is it the supernatural aspect that they can't deal with? The uncertainty, even though you know God's going to come through tomorrow morning, it's the uncertainty of waiting for it that may be what's bothering them. But would that be justifiable? Is that a valid complaint? Perhaps not. Vayizaku bnei Yisrael el Hashem. That's at Yam Suf. That's at Yam Suf. Correct. There's no doubt. Absolutely. In Yam Suf, you have that. And there, Moshe turns to Hashem, and Hashem says to Moshe, don't bother me. You know, I already listened to Bnei Yisrael. Go on. You make the question sharper by raising that. I mean, thank you for raising it. But I'm not ready to give an answer. I think that the general observation that they don't cry out and they don't pray is a correct one. You raise the I hope it's the only counterexample. And I think we'd have to look. I mean, I to give an off-the-cuff answer, I wouldn't be comfortable. If even there it comes in the midst of the complaints against Moshe. Vayitzaku bnei Yisrael Hashem, but it's very interesting. What do they say at that point? Vayomru el Moshe. So the tzaaka el Hashem is formulated as a statement to Moshe of why did you take us out to bury us here in Egypt? In other words, you're right. Yud Dalid Yud does conclude Vayetzaku v'nei Yisrael al Hashem, but Yud Aleph is Vayomru Moshe Mibliyin Kvarim Mitzrayim. So we could even read how do Bnei Yisrael entreat Hakadosh Baruch Hu via their comments to Moshe. But I think it requires a little bit of further thought. I think the point is well taken. We then get in the middle here in the story an interruption by the narrator. All of a sudden, the narrator has to remind us what man is. This is what it looks like. This is how they would gather it. This is how they would prepare it. This is how they would cook it. This is what it tasted like. This is how it was served to them. Zion, Chet, Tet, an interruption about the man. Precisely. Number one, it's authoritative. Because it's the narrator, it's very much like the comment following Miriam and Aharon's complaint about Moshe, the narrator, Vaish Moshe Anav Me'od. All right? The words of the narrator coming to counter the previous piece of the story, namely, the people here are complaining for no reason. But notice the nature of the comments. It's easy to prepare. You get it every day. Tam Lishad Hashamen, how dare you say Nafshenu Yiveishad, dried out? It's the moistness or the moisture of the man which is stressed in this description, in addition to the way various ways you can prepare it. I mean, we don't have the Bnei Yisrael did not leave us, or Benot Yisrael did not leave us, you know, 1,001 ways to prepare man. I'm sure that was the bestseller in the Sisterhoods of the Desert. But the fact is, the interruption by the narrator is meant to undercut immediately the attitude of the people and to make it very clear that before the rest of the story continues, we are not to take their complaint at face value. We are to be somewhat biased against them because their complaint has been shown, even before the story proceeds, to be somewhat without a foundation, without basis. Let's put it this way. Certainly, the guarantee of its presence, the Yveisha part certainly plays against them. And the fact is that there are a variety of ways to prepare it. I don't think that it supports them. If you may tell me it does not undermine their complete complaint, but it certainly takes away the major portion. Yeah, there's no question about it. If you look later on at the complaint in Perek Kaf Aleph, they come to Moshe and they say, "V'nafshenu katsa balechem haklokel." We're disgusted already by eating this lightweight food all of the time, or if klokel means something like that. So there is a sense of monotony, although that's not what they seem to. That's not what they're. Well, okay, monotony. And on the other hand, the fact is there is a guarantee they have it all the time. Immediately, yeah. Maybe. Right. I mean, it's man in the morning and the all day man, and we don't, you know. By the way, if anything, I hear again, without getting involved in how we to understand Midrashim, if we're going to read it this way, we have done serious damage to the famous Midrash that the man tasted like whatever you wanted. You know the difference between an answer and a teretz? The difference between an answer and a teretz is that after the teretz, the question is still there. That's a teretz. All right. So we now get a reaction. Now the people's part in this story is virtually done. They have shown their colors. They have this complaint. They don't know who's going to give them the food that they really want. But it is different from the earlier situations. As I said, in Shemot, they really had a right to ask for food because they didn't have. Here, they're saying, we want something better. And remember, if they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael, they didn't know they were going to eat the man for 40 years. Right? As far as they know, they can eat the man for another week and a half, and they're going to be in Eretz Yisrael then, and they can live off Tuat Haaretz. So, you know, we can at least keep that in mind as well. Moshe hears the people. God becomes angry. Uve'ene Moshe ra. It's a very funny sequence. Just a year. A year. Right. I understand. We'd be tired of ice cream after a year also. I mean, the monotony point is an important one. I do not mean to discount it. Yeah. Right. Right, that's right. They're testing. And I will tell you here, I will anticipate that they are testing, and this is one of the ways in which the Mishorer in Mizmor Memchet picks up the story. His opening line of the story, Yud Zayin Yud Chet, after God has given them water, from the rock, Vayusifu od lachatolo, they continued to sin against him, lamrot elyon batziah, to rebel against the Most High in the desolation. Vayinasu el bilvavam lishol ochel lenafsham. They tested God in their heart to ask food for themselves. Vayidabru belohim, they spoke against God, amru, hayuchal el la'aroch shulchan bamidbar. They said, can God give us a banquet in the desert? This is they. This is they. And I'll come back to Moshe in a moment. But it's certainly the way that the Mishorer seems to be reading this section, Tilam 7, Ayin Chet, Yud Zayin through Lamed Aleph, is this Parsha. There's a little bit of conflation with some of the other stories about food, but the focus is here, and I can show it pretty clearly. Notice that Moshe says, Moshe reacts, Uveinei Moshe Ra, he doesn't like it. And notice in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Moshe begins to complain to God even before God has said anything. Moshe takes this personally. Greeted your servant. The last word of the section is Ve'al ere bira'ati. Let me not see this rotten situation any further. And it reminds you of the very same words spoken by Moshe in Perakei of Shmot, Pasuk Kafbet Kafgimel, when he comes back after his first visit to Paro, the king of Egypt. Lama hareota la'am hazeh, lama zeh shelachtani, why are you maltreating this people? Umeaz bati el paro ledaber bishmecha heira la'am hazeh, ever since I came to Paro to speak in your name, he has mistreated this people. There too I have a hareota heira, here I have a hareota and bira'ati. You can't help thinking of it, if I may say so, Moshe hasn't learned his lesson here. Moshe doesn't recall what's God's words to him right after that. So, but Moshe doesn't seem to remember God's answer, and all of a sudden, he's complaining. And if you think, and that's nothing compared to v'lama lo matzati chen be'enecha. Why have I not found favor in your eyes? Excuse me, Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe says HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Perek Lamed Gimel Shmot, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Va'ata im matzati chen be'enecha, hodieni na'et derachecha ve'edacha lima'an imtza chen be'enecha. If I have found favor in your eyes, you know, I would like to know you so that I may find favor in your eyes. And what is God's response there in Perek Lamed Gimel Pasuk Yud Zayin? Gam et hadavar hazeh asher dibarte e'esa, I will do as you wish. Ki matzata chen ve'enai va'edacha v'shem, because you have found favor in my eyes. I mean, Moshe is the one who says, Im na matzati chen ve'enecha Hashem, yelech na Hashem bekirbenu. And God does so. So Moshe has had all the proofs that he has found favor in God's eyes. And Moshe is saying, V'lama lo matzati chen ve'enecha. Now, admittedly, perhaps we should distinguish between the people and Moshe to some degree. But like the people, and I think it's very striking, like the people, he too seems not to remember earlier events. I wouldn't yet call... I mean, there is a question of faith, a question of trust, and it's also perhaps a problem. It is going to be a problem with his leadership. Yeah. God hasn't done anything yet. Well, that's back in Shemot. But here, but what is he doing here? He's saying, obviously, you don't like me very much. How is this shown? Lasumet masakola amaze alai. Right? Moshe is making assumptions about his own responsibility to lead the people. It's all my burden. Think back to his first dialogue with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where he says, Shlach na biyad tishlach, I don't want any of this. This is not my kind of job. I'm not right for it. But notice how Moshe thrusts himself into the spotlight here as if the whole complaint is focused upon him. Furthermore, he does not do what he does back in Shmot, which is to leap to the defense of the people. Here, he seems to be as condemnatory as God. He does not do the job, the leader, the Omeid Baperetz, who is supposed to stand there and intercede, interpose himself between God and his people. Moshe says, why did you do this to me? Why did you dump the burden of this people upon me? But does that give Moshe the right to ask to act like this?
Because 3 days after Har Sinai they can act like this, God knows what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
3 days since they left Har Sinai.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the point is, though...
But
I still... Okay, granting that Moshe is... I would still say Moshe is overreacting. I think the word tantrum is a correct term. This, by the way, may be one of the longest speeches that Moshe gives anywhere in Chumash. This speech actually runs for six psukim, which is a fairly long set piece. Absolutely. But he now puts... He puts all of the blame, five psukim, not six, I can't count. He puts all of the blame on God. And it reminds you of what he says in the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, Lo uchal anochi levadi, Lo uchal levadi se'et etchem, and Eicha asa levadi tarchachem. God has dumped this burden upon him. The imagery which is used here, however, is very, very interesting. He says, you have I borne this people? I give birth to them because you, God, are telling me to carry him in your bosom as a maid or a maid carries an infant to the land which you swore to its ancestors. Now, the image of parent and child is one which we frequently find between, let's say, God and Am Yisrael, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, and so on. Moshe, in a certain sense, even further, is arrogating to himself in this complaint that he's making something of God's role. He's saying, are they my children? Now, the image of the child is very appropriate here because Bnei Yisrael are throwing a tantrum. Bnei Yisrael are indeed acting like children. So the image of Moshe saying, you're telling me, am I supposed to, schlep these infants along until we get to Eretz Yisrael? It's the masculine of a nursemaid, and it would mean a servant who would take care of a child, which it probably does. In Esther. But Moshe again here, first of all, he comments before God does. He complains in a way that shows he doesn't remember earlier events. He describes his role vis-a-vis the people in a fashion that God never imposed upon him, in a fashion which is much more characteristic of the role of God. I would even go so far as to read that reference, Al ha'adama shenishbata la'avotav, as ominous once we know the end of the story. Is it the fact that Moshe has trouble with the people in this context a flaw in his ability to lead them into the land? There's certainly an irony in the fact that neither he nor this group of Israelites ever makes it into Eretz Yisrael. So the words Al Hadama Shenishbata La'avotav, which are innocent on the first reading, on all subsequent readings, has to be taken with a bit of a chill here, because it's a very eerie anticipation of what is not going to happen. Furthermore, Moshe then quotes the people, May Ayin Li Basar Latet Lochol Ha'am Hazeh. Moshe, excuse me, who asked you? Again, Moshe sees himself as the object, right? The Meshorer and Tehillim understood it better. He said, "Hayuchal el aruch shulchan bamidbar." This was not directed at Moshe, but Moshe is so much on edge that he's this is another complaint at me. They're directing another thing at me.
Attention to himself to keep some terrible punishment from happening.
I love the creativity. I don't. I think it's remote. There's a piece of it that I actually like. I don't think it's pshat. The problem with a reading like that, and this is always the problem we have when we try to do close readings, especially when there's gapping, and we try to fill the gaps, is that ikar chaser min hasefer. You never would have known, you know, most readers of the text are not going to see it, and it's almost a counter reading. It's a strong counter reading. I like the idea of it, but I don't think that's the sense. I don't know. I mean, it's not out of question, but I don't think it's likely. Yeah. 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 Not there. That's later. This part is not Bnei Ephraim. The early part's definitely not Bnei Ephraim. Fine. There's a very strong. There seems to be an anti-Ephraim bias in this mizmar. That seems to be the case, and it may be post split of the kingdoms. And there are several possibilities in the time of Yeravam. There are a number of possibilities there, but the text itself, the body of the mizmar, clearly deals with the same desert wanderings that are described in. I'm not so sure. We could argue about that, and if we do to something at Tehillim, maybe we'll argue about it. But I'm not convinced that that's the only way to read it. I think there it does. Good, because there you have an explicit Vayim Aspa Ohel Yosef there. There's no question about that there. Okay, Moshe thinks that that Miachilenu means Tana Lanu Basar V'Nochela, give it to us. And he, for the first time, and the only time perhaps, Moshe gives up completely. In Pasuk Tetvav, if this is how you're going to treat me, kill me already, I don't need any more of this aggravation. Can you imagine Moshe Rabbeinu doing this? Is this the Moshe Rabbeinu we know from Sefer Shemot? Again, here I wonder about this being, this person, as the leader. There's something, a leader can't respond this way. I don't know. He doesn't say it that way. But he may very well. This may be his way of expressing the fact that I'm an unsuccessful leader. No, this I agree with, yes. Yes. Yes, I think children talk that way. Right, enough is enough already. Now look at God's response, and it's interesting that there is a the parsha break takes place before God's response. And again, God's response is to be divided up into two parts. One, Psukim Tetzayin Yudzayin, which is the response to the question that Moshe raised, namely the leadership question. You're having trouble being a leader? I'll give you assistance. Right? Get together these people, and here we have Asaf again, Esfali, and bring them to Ohel Moed. And you get some funny language that's used here and in the subsequent section. You get things like V'yatzvu shamimach v'yaradati v'dibarti imcha sham, which reminds you a little bit of the language in the aftermath of the Egel HaZahav, V'yared Hashem be'anan v'yatzevi mosham. Clearly, we're getting an inversion of that language. The language is being used, maybe turned on its head a little bit. and I'm going to make them your assistants. You're not going to be alone. Then, Velaam Tomar Hitkachu L'Machar. And of course, Hitkachu L'Machar picks up the language of Matan Torah, V'kidashtam Hayomu Machar. Except V'kidashtam Hayomu Machar from Matan Torah was for a glorious experience. Here, Hitkachu L'Machar V'achaltem Basar is black comedy. It's turned on its head. It's a parody of Matan Torah. Here, they're going to be sick from this Hitkachu L'Machar V'achaltem Basar. It's clearly what it means here. No. On the contrary, it means prepare yourselves, get ready, sanctify yourselves. But it's sarcastic. You're going to have it. There's going to be a revelation, but it's not going to be the glorious revelation of Sinai. It's an imitation. And then look what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, because Ki bechitem bo'oznei Hashem lemor miyachilenu basar ki tov lanu b'mitzrayim. They didn't say Ki Tov Lanu B'Mitzrayim, but God heard it. They just said Miyachilenu Basar, but God heard Zacharnu Et Hadagash and Ochal B'Mitzrayim Chinam, and realized that what they're saying is Ki Tov Lanu B'Mitzrayim. And the response tells you about how he judges the people and their lack of faith in him. Notice the response to their greed, which is Yudchet through the beginning of Kaf. That is to say, you're going to get food for a good long time, and you're going to eat it. You're going to eat it until it comes out of your nose. You know, it's going to be disgusting. But the second part of Pasuk Kaf is a response not just to the greed, but to the looking back at Egypt. Yan ki ma'astem et Hashem asher b'kirbechem atibku lefanav lemor lama zeh yatzanu mimitzrayim. First of all, notice ma'as, which is a very strong term. You've rejected, you've despised God, number one. And number two, God turns their complaint now into a question. Why did we ever leave Egypt? This is turning it on its head and more. And here we see Moshe once again. Moshe didn't hear what God said. Moshe says, how am I going to do this? I'm here in the middle. I am here. Anochi. I'm in the middle of a people of 600,000. And you said, Basar etein lahem. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean you said, quote, I, namely God, will give them meat? Or you said that I, namely Moshe, will give them meat? It's ambiguous. But Moshe seems still to be thinking about himself. Does he still... Does he think that he is responsible? Does he think that feeding the people is his job? And how can you find so much animals to kill, so much fish, and so on? And there's a discussion in Chazal. What? Yeah, it wouldn't be enough. Good question. But how could it be enough? Okay, so there's a three-way machloket in Chazal as to what this means, and I'm only going to mention one view. That's the view of Rabbi Akiva, who clearly is pshat, who says Moshe really doubts HaKadosh Baruch Hu's word. Moshe says, "How in the hakol kimashma'o mi maspik lahem? How can anybody possibly supply them?" And Ramban, in a long discussion, points out that both of the other views are not pshat, and clearly Rabbi Akiva is pshat. Moshe seems to lose faith as well. And is it? It's concomitant. Whether the other views tell me something psychologically about the people, that they're just looking for an excuse. It doesn't matter how much food you give them. You give them roast beef, they'll say we want the corned beef. You give them veal, they're going to say we want the chicken. It doesn't matter, Moshe says. No matter what you give them, they're not going to want it. Now that may be psychologically true. The people may be looking for complaints. But Pshuto Shel Mikra, Rabbi Akiva is still right, namely, Mi Maspik Lahem, how can we possibly have enough? You see, how can you possibly have enough food for them? Excuse me, what's God's reaction? Hayad Hashem Tiktsar? Certainly the simple sense of God's response tells me that Rabbi Akiva is the only right reading. Rabbi Akiva says, Hakol Kemashma'o, Mi Maspik Lahem. How can anybody supply enough food for them? One says, no matter how much you give them, it's not going to be enough. And the other one is, what kind of God are you who's going to give them food and then kill them off? Do you do that with an animal? Do you say to a chamor, you know, tol korso rim v'acharkach nachtoch et roshcha? Which is a somewhat peculiar reading, but the first one that I mentioned does tell me something correct psychologically. Namely, this group, are looking for excuses. Notice that, again, there's a parsha break before God's speech, which apparently is quite typical of Torah as we see it. Does he see Moshe as lacking faith? He says, Hayad Hashem Tiktsar, Atat Tireh Yikrecha Dvarim Lo. You're going to see whether this happens or not. So it looks like from God's final comment that he does not think Moshe has responded appropriately. Moshe, again, acts on God's words, gathers the elders, once again, Asaf, stands them around, Vayered Hashem Be'anan Vaydaber Elav, once again, language which we know from Shemot 34, again, the reuse of language from the earlier stories. And then you get this funny interlude here, 70 Zekanim, and two guys named Eldad Umedad who are standing there and prophesying. Now, who knows what they're prophesying? I don't know. But the Midrash says something very interesting. The Midrash gives me the content of the prophecy of Eldad and Medad. And it's very interesting what the two prophecies are. We'll forget the third one, which is Gog and Magog. Let's just deal with things at hand. Number one, it's the Slav. The Eldad and Medad are prophesying about the Slav. Number two, they're prophesying Moshe met v'Yehoshua machnis. That Moshe is not going to bring the people in, Yehoshua will. It's very interesting how these two prophecies correspond to the design or the outline of the parasha, the way I've been characterizing it, one responding to the people's complaint or lack of faith, and the other perhaps showing us that Moshe's leadership has really deteriorated to a certain point where this is not going to be a success. Ironically, it is then Yehoshua who jumps up to defend Moshe and Moshe's unique position. And here, we have to vindicate Moshe, because the Torah does. The Torah says, Moshe's not an elitist. I'm not an elitist. Halavai, everybody should be Nevi'im. And remember that this anticipates, parenthetically, Perek Yud Beit once again, where Miriam and Aaron say, hey, Moshe thinks he's such a big shot because God speaks to him. How can you say that? Moshe's the one who just said in Perek Yud Aleph, Umi'itein kolam Hashem Nevi'im, halavai, everybody should be a prophet. Here, too, you see that the argument of Miriam and Aaron is refuted in advance by the narrative of Perek Yud Aleph, in a certain sense. Noticing also the use of Ki'itein Hashem et Rucho Aleihem, God's Ruach, right before V'ruach Nasa Me'et Hashem in Pasuk Lamed Aleph. I have the Ruach of Hashem in Kaftet, I have the Ruach Hashem in Lamed Aleph. One is beneficial and prophetic, and one is negative and damaging. And very quickly, the Slav arrive, they pile up, the people eat it, and vast quantities. The commentators deal with it. I'm not going to worry about that from the standpoint of the narrative. Maybe they, depends, you know, how much you complain. The Rishonim and Achronim all deal with that question. It may not be literal. It may not be literal. I mean, what I want to underline, though, is notice Hamamit Asaf Asara Chamorim. The one who gathered the least gathered 10 piles. And contrast that with Shmot Tet Zayin Yud Chet. When the food is being handled properly, everybody gathers exactly the same amount. No matter how much, how little, everybody gathers exactly the right amount. Ober lagul golet, the way it's described back in Shemot Tet Zayin. The use of hamamit must recall that pasuk and holds up the people's behavior here. And you know what? It's more than gluttony. It shows they have no faith. Because if I have to gather it all up now, it means I don't trust God to give me tomorrow. There's a kind of mentality that I have to have it, I have to have it, without realizing that how did I get all of this, and where is it going to all come from tomorrow? They still lack faith, despite the miracle, and they still don't have trust in God. And it's almost irrational. And the parsha ends with divine anger, and the place is named, and the story's over. Moshe never interceded in this story. It's not like all the other ones. Moshe's a little bit vindicated, but to a degree. I just want to point out a couple of things in the Tehillim before pulling it all together. In the description there, we read a little bit of it already. The people say, after all, God struck the rock and water flowed. Can he also give us food and prepare flesh for his people? God heard and he got angry, and a fire blazed in Yaakov, and anger went up against Yisrael. I wonder if that Esh Niskabi Yaakov may be some kind of allusion to Taveirah, even though it comes earlier. Because Vayit Abar and Tav Eira are anagrams. Ki lo he'eminu be'lohim v'lo vatchu b'shuato. The Mishorah says it explicitly. There's a lack of faith, a lack of trust. Lo he'eminu. And of course, God gives them everything they want. Lechem abirim, man lechol, degan shamayim, and so on and so forth. The birds fall in the camp. Vayochlu vayisbe'u me'od. V'ta'avatam yavilahem. God brought them just what they lusted for. Lozaru mita'avatam. Od ochlam b'fihem. The food was still in their mouths. V'af Elohim alav vahem v'yarog mishmanehem uvachurei Yisrael hichriya. And God's anger immediately rose against them again and killed some of them off. You can see from the discussion there, that summary that you get in Tehillim, the focus on the lack of faith, the lack of trust. It focuses on the people, of course, not on Moshe. But it focuses on lack of faith and lack of trust. And this is what we've seen in the people in the parasha itself. The inability to live under supernatural guidance, the lack of real trust in God sustaining them, a very quick regression to thinking about how good Egypt used to be, the questioning of God, mi achilenu basar, forgetting about all the past miracles that they've seen, forgetting about Matan Torah, and forgetting about Eretz Yisrael. And you wonder if, seeing the people like this, you just know that something like the Meraglim is going to happen. Is this backward glance to Egypt already fatal in terms of the people's later progress through the desert? On the other hand, when we look at Moshe, we see flaws both as a leader and as one who trusts in Hashem momentarily. We see, as we saw in the earliest part of the story here, maybe Moshe's personality is consistent. A resentment of the fact that God thrust leadership upon him. Leadership is imposed on Moshe. And to a slight degree, we see him acting like the children with whom he is dealing. On the other hand, when Yoshua comes and it's a question of Moshe's own ego and pride, he says, Chas v'shalom, mi yiten kol am Hashem. There's a nobility in the answer. Does the fact that Moshe shows a shortcoming as leader here set in motion inexorably the fact that he can't lead them into Eretz Yisrael? We can't be certain. But there's reason to worry. Because if you see a generation failing, if you see a people failing, the leaders of that people, the leaders of that group, may have no right to say, well, they're no good, but you can take me. And even more so when you see the leader also showing a certain kind of shakiness, a certain lack of confidence in what he's doing, that when you read Bahalotcha and you think about the nature of this parsha, and we then move ahead to read in Shlach, we are not all that surprised, perhaps, to see the tragic events unfold in Shlach and then later at Meimrivah, which ultimately prevent both Moshe and the people from entering the land Asher Nishbata Lavotav. Right. Okay, I think that's correct. That's a good hara. But there is this, you come out of the story very unsettled. Some of it's the way it's expressed. I think there's too much ego in the way it's expressed. In the way that he says, "What do you expect from me?" I mean, if he had stopped and waited, even the very fact he speaks up before God says anything. But and in the past, all he does is he turns to God, and God tells him what's going to be. Here he jumps in, and he jumps in with himself. I think we can see what's going to happen. Yeah, I think what you're right. Yeah, yeah. Because fundamentally he is. In fact, maybe in order to undercut any inferences that we're drawing on that this is, Moshe has this, big character flaw, the Torah tells us perhaps that's not, don't draw all your conclusions from seeing what happened here, because fundamentally Moshe is anav. In fact, the behavior when Yoshua comes to him shows that he is anav.
How do you define anav?
Not particularly self-centered. Not excessively self-involved. Some of these things have to be taken up with the Rabbanu Shel Olam. Yeah. I think you're counter reading in the narrative. I think you would agree with me. It's clever, but I don't think it works. It's interesting. There's several descriptions of the appointment of leaders. You have the one in Yitro, you have the one here, and you have the one at the beginning of Dvarim, which looks like it's borrowing from both of them. In Moshe's description, it doesn't seem to follow Yitro, yet it uses Yitro language, yet it also uses the same lo'uchal laseit that's found here. It's almost as a combination. I mean, is one judicial and one executive, and there are all kinds of ways of dealing with it, but it's clear that Moshe in his retelling has drawn both on the Yitro story and on the Bahalotcha story in order to give you the version that he gives you in the beginning of Dvarim. He never says. Clearly, God sees this as a response. Doesn't seem to be. Yeah, he wants help. He wants help. Yeah. Yeah. Right. 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 And in the next day, he doesn't do it. Somehow, there is a contrast. Oh, he takes it personally. There's no question he takes it personally. I you're right. It's still there. I think that integrates quite well with the line that I've taken. I think even the idea, by the way, that slaves very often may have childish mentalities, people who are kept subservient, who don't develop their intellect and their own free spirit, may very well be describable, and that's why the child image works very well. Yeah, no, I think that you know, he realizes it there. I'll tell you, the point at which it becomes clear, Moshe falls on his face at no point until Meraglim. When Moshe falls on his face, after Meraglim, he does it all the time. As soon as they say, Nitna Rosh V'Nashuva Mitzrayma, that's when Moshe knows it's over. That's when he knows for sure that there's no hope. At which point he falls on his face in utter frustration. That's later. That's later. I said, once he falls on his face in Meraglim, he keeps on doing it. Reshul Mitzrayma. And the next words are that Moshe and Aaron fall on their faces, I hope. Yeah. So that, I mean, once he, that's the first time. Because I... But that's the... He breaks down as leader. I think that's the ultimate frustration as leader. Where he hears them say, let's appoint a leader and go back. And from there on, at every slightest excuse, Moshe falls on his face. If you look at all of them, at Korach, at Me'rivah, at all of them, Moshe's falling on his face.
Okay, so could it be that when Hashem sent Raisa Karen Rodos before, and stayed when he was rational, and he handled things
properly? Look, it's very difficult. I mean, readings like this, and obviously there are people who get frustrated with readings like this because we are dealing with the characters as they are described. The fact is, when the Torah says Ish Moshe Anav Me'od, it goes a long way in rehabilitating and reinvigorating Moshe's character as far as the reader is concerned.
No, it was said at a point where he was Anav
Me'od. I think he's Anav Me'od throughout. I think that this...
No.
Yeah, but it's a relative term that it's all-inclusive. You're right, I mean... It's limited to all of humanity. That's as unlimited as it. It's superlative, not limited. I read it as superlative. Well, no, that was my reading was that, and yeah. In Hakanami, but that's what, that may be why the Torah comes back and rehabilitates and restates it.
When does it
stay? How does it stay? With the Aish Moshe Anav Me'od.
Yeah, but
despite what we just saw. No, that's after. That's in Yud Beit. It's Yud Beit. It's the next parak. No, it happens after this story. Even though we've seen Moshe and Perek Yud Aleph be a little bit self-involved, the Torah Yud Beit tells us Ha'ish Moshe Anav Me'od. Right. But I don't. Okay, I don't know whether Anav is related to leadership skills, though. That's a different issue. Right. But it's interesting that this is the one place of the stories until now where he doesn't immediately step into the breach, and where he doesn't turn to God, doesn't even let God get a word in edgewise. He gets his own word in first, which is very uncharacteristic. And that's what made me look at it that way, because you find him speaking before he gives God a chance to say anything. And he loses his temper, of course. It's Ha'ish Moshe. It's Ha'ish Moshe. Right? Moshe is an Ish. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Maybe it helps psychologically. The notion that the leader is not alone, that you have an advisory council, maybe it's of great psychological help. The idea it's not all... And you can work with him, and you have... the Torah only gives us what it wants to. That's what gives us the opportunity either to darshan or to try to squeeze in or to read in. But it doesn't seem to be judicial, and it may just be the notion of sharing the burden. In other words, v'lo tisa ata levadecha. Why are you complaining? Masa, masa, burden, burden. Now you're not going to have such a burden anymore. Okay. Yeah, that's clearly the nature of this. You don't hear from Eldad Umeidat ever again. And there's a very peculiar Targum of Yonatan, which we're not going to talk about. Who they are, what they are. I mean, clear the name. The names are, they rhyme. It's the names are peculiar, but they're not there anymore. They come on the scene for the moment. It's enigmatic. What does Vehema Baktuvim mean? The midrash about them being modest. I mean, the midrash makes them very modest. They don't want to take the kavod and go out there, which is also very interesting. Sometimes the midrashic readings do sort of shed a funny kind of light, refract a funny kind of light on the parasha itself.